Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, Mary, Joseph, and the three wise men in St. Peter's Basilica in time for Christmas Eve, a tradition that doesn't go back as far as you'd think. And the women saints of Advent. Can you guess who they are? If you walk or drive by St. Peter's Basilica, you can't fail to see the towering Christmas tree and the continuing work on the life-sized nativity scene in the center of the colonnaded square. While it's the one to get all the attention once it's unveiled, it's not the only creche or nativity scene for St. Peter's. Inside the basilica, construction is underway on another presepe, as nativity scenes are called here in Italy, and the San Pietrini, St. Peter's workmen, are putting their utmost creativity and their very hearts into the project.
Per noi è una cosa che attendiamo ogni anno e ci mettiamo tutto del nostro, il massimo impegno per cercare di far.
Maurizio Trevisiol is one of the San Pietrini working on the presepe. He says they're putting their all into it because millions of people pass through the doors of the basilica and they want to make their presepe as special for them as possible.
Cerchiamo di far vedere le nostre opere nel miglior modo possibile.
I think most people do stop once they come in the basilica for Christmas. This is really a highlight of the Christmas ceremony and celebrations.
Cristina Carlo Stella is the general manager of the Fabrica of St. Peter's, the office responsible for the maintenance and smooth running of the basilica. Andrea Benedetti is responsible for a lot of that smooth running. Himself a San Pietrino, he worked his way up to supervisor. He was overseeing the Nativity's construction when I visited. I wanted to know how the tradition for a presepe in St. Peter's Basilica got started. For a 500-year-old basilica, I was a bit surprised by his answer.
Questa tradizione nasce nel 93, quando uno scultore.
It came about in 1993, he told me, when a German sculptor donated a series of almost life-size statues to the basilica so that Cardinal Noé, the basilica's former archpriest, would create a nativity scene within the basilica so pilgrims would have a place to reflect and to pray for a holy Christmas. In Italy, building a presepe, he explains, is a tradition that is cherished from generation to generation. At first, the presepe was set up facing the central nave, but as more and more people began coming to see it and more figures were added to it, the presepe was eventually moved to the Presentation, or the Pius X chapel, in the left aisle of the basilica.
Madonna, San Giuseppe, Gesù, poi abbiamo un bue, un asinello.
There are all of your traditional figures in the St. Peter's Nativity scene: Mary, Joseph, the Christ child, a donkey, an ox, and the three wise men. There's also a man lighting a torch, sheep and lambs, all works by the same German sculptor. The San Pietrini have added running water and lights and have created chickens, ducks, and more sheep out of clay, which they fired and painted themselves.
Fatte in terracotta e poi pitturate dai San Pietrini, dai nostri pittori.
Every year, the San Pietrini try to change a little bit the setting of the crash scene. Not really the sediment. You always have the crash. You always have either the cave or the, it's either a cave or a stable or a hut where the actual nativity scene takes place. But the surroundings. And I think This again reflects very much a tradition that developed perhaps more in Naples in the 1500s, 1600s, whereby the nativity scene is actually, and we see this also in paintings of the period, the nativity scene is placed within the actual traditional milieu of the time. So the nativity scene, the Christ scene is inserted even here in St. Peter, usually, San Pietrini want to insert it within sort of a genre kind of atmosphere. So you've got, you know, perhaps the little workshop of people doing their jobs, the metal worker or the peasant walking down the street, and various elements of nature. This year, for example, our San Pietrini are very excited because they are going to try to even insert a mill, a water mill that is turning close to a waterfall. Every single year they try to elaborate and develop a particular aspect.
It seems to mean a lot to each and every one of them to be creating this nativity scene in the heart of Christianity, the one of the most important basilicas in all of Christendom.
Well, I think we're really very, very lucky. Both myself and Cardinal Camastri and His Excellency Lanzani, all the superiors of the Fabrica San Pietro, were very, very happy to see how our staff really gets involved. They are very much aware that they're working for a very, very special basilica, for a very special place, the center of Christianity. And so they, for example, even for this setting up this nativity scene, they put all their efforts so that there's almost, can I say, there's almost a competition between the Christ scene that's made and designed by our own San Pietrini and the monumental, beautiful Christ scene that is set up in the middle of St. Peter's Square. So they really take it at heart. They really want every year to improve the best they can the San Pietrini Christ scenes.
Another San Pietrino who's giving his best to the creation of the Presepe is Franco Umbro.
For me, it's a very important occasion because this is the first time that I start to prepare Presepe Nativity. It's a very important situation for me because it's inside the church, the biggest church in the world, and with a group that is very enthusiastic to build this Nativity.
The team he's talking about consists of some 12 to 15 carpenters, bricklayers, plumbers, and electricians who work flat out for 2 to 3 weeks so that the San Pietrini creche will be ready for Christmas Eve, when the Pope himself will come personally to the chapel to place the Christ child in the manger.
Il Santo Padre poi verrà in questo presepe la notte di Natale a depositare il bambinello, il Gesù. E quindi abbiamo questo grande, diciamo, privilegio.
They're San Pietrini and proud of it, and their presepe.
Dei San Pietrini, Treviso, Cipolla, Salvatori, d'Arcangeli, idraulici, Imbravuglio, Umbro, Menegozzi, sono tutti presenti che sono qua, poi se dimentichiamo qualcuno, però tutte le idee sono loro, ecco.
Each year the team starts out with a plan for the Christmas manger scene, and each San Pietrino contributes ideas and changes as construction progresses. Andrea Menegozzi is just one of the brains behind the San Pietrini Presepe. He makes miniature manger scenes as a hobby all year round.
Questa passione è nata, diciamo, dalla famiglia.
Andrea says it's a passion that began in his family. When he was little, his mother used to make a presepe with the family in the living room. And now he does the same with his own two little girls every Christmas to prepare for the coming of the baby Jesus.
Per la venuta di Gesù.
I make these presepe for family and friends, he says, as a reminder that Christmas is a spiritual time. It's not simply the commercial holiday as it's unfortunately become today. My presepe are gifts of Christmas spirit, reminders that this is the birth of Jesus, our Savior. The presepe does indeed remind us of the birth of the Christ child, and since the tradition of making nativity scenes dates as far back as St. Francis, who created the first one back in the 1200s, I did think it odd that the 500-year-old St. Peter's Basilica would not have had a nativity tradition before 1993.
As a matter of fact, even if we look at some of the records in the historical archive, the Fabrica, there wasn't really a set tradition of setting up a crush scene inside. By word of mouth, from the oldest San Pietrini who worked here, I was told that they did set up a very tiny crush scene somewhere in the middle of the nave, of the central nave. But it was something that was placed, I think, only very, very temporarily for a couple of days, maybe for the staff. I'm not so sure how that was actually carried out or why it was decided. So it was a tradition that was not really a permanent one. It was just something that was an ad hoc decision. I don't think that in past centuries, you had that tradition, actually. We don't have any records of it.
Because the tradition of having a nativity scene actually came about in the 1200s with St. Francis.
Exactly. I think here in Rome, the city of Rome really offers a wonderful opportunity to see how this tradition of crèche scenes inside the churches in interior sacred spaces has developed, because it's not only St. Peter Basilica, but during Christmas, for those visitors who are planning to come to Rome, be prepared that for Christmas, almost every major basilica or major church has set up its own beautiful crèche scenes. These crèche scenes vary from antique crèche scenes, Neapolitan, from the Neapolitan tradition, to modern crèche scene versions. As a matter of fact, there is a very large exhibit at Piazza del Popolo of, I think, hundreds of different crèche scenes from various places. And
many of them, in fact, they're international, and many of them, I've been there myself, and I've seen the tags on them, and they come from the Vatican. They were donated to the Holy Father or to the Vatican.
Exactly. Now, I think this is a very beautiful, popular devotional tradition, and I mean, I'm not from Rome. We don't have that up north. I know that in Milano we really don't have. Yes, we do make the crèche. A lot of families set up the crèche scene in their own individual homes, but it's not that every single church, for example, in Milan has a crèche scene. But in Rome, this is a very, very powerful tradition, and è una tradizione molto sentita, as they say in Italian. People really love to go around just in a pilgrimage, for example, on Christmas Day or on Christmas Eve or right after Christmas with their families, and they go from one church to another.
Well, among the thousands to stop to admire the St. Peter's Nativity scene, all of the San Pietrini who worked so hard to build it will be there, along with family and friends. So, what will their kids have to say?
Magari sono loro che dicono a me che
piacciono. Maurizio says they'll tell me whether they like it or not. But I think they'll say, "Bravo, Daddy, it's really beautiful."
Papà ha fatto un bel lavoro, papà molto bello.
Of all the saints we remember during the Advent season, two are women. Any idea who they are? Well, of course, the first to come to mind is the Virgin Mary, whose Feast of the Immaculate Conception falls on December 8th. The second is the lesser known but much loved St. Lucy, celebrated December 13th. Father Bernard O'Connor of the Congregation for Eastern Churches explained to me the impact of women like these on the church and the faithful.
When we look at the canon of the Mass, and especially if we look at the development of the Eucharistic canon, we see references to women regularly. Agatha, we call Agnes. Various women's names appear regularly. In feast days that are familiar to the Latin Christians, you see women's names continually, and these have historic precedent, especially when you think of saints like Cecilia, though she's not commemorated during Advent, but known from the early church. St. Lucy, who we're going to speak about today, was very, very well known in the earliest years of the church, before even our liturgy and liturgical calendar had developed as it has today. So the mission of women, the vitality of the contribution of women, the positive energizing of faith communities by women is all through Catholic history. Very appropriate for Lent, because if we're welcoming a Christ to come, his return, we have to recognize where Christ has already come, and that is in the heart and witness of Christian women.
One of the women, you just mentioned her, that we're speaking about today is St. Lucy, Santa Lucia.
Santa Lucia. If I could sing, I'd hum at least hum a few bars.
Tell us a little bit more about her. She was one of the early Christian martyrs, wasn't she?
In fact, she was probably born about the year 283. And so in the 3rd century, well known. And before her death, she was very young when she was martyred, probably somewhere around 303. 52 years before, we had already had other great martyr, female martyr, well-known Saint Agatha. And again, it was already becoming important to the Christian community, not only to see where women have given themselves and have sacrificed themselves all through their lives and then in death, but to recognize that that became their call. So what we call the cult of the martyrs was already taking a prominent feature in ordinary Christian life. People were wanting to examine their lives. They were wanting to make pilgrimages to their tomb. They were wanting to have relics to be part of the structure of their whole civic communities as well. They were so wanting the spirit of this martyr, of this saint, to infuse their daily existence that they went to great ends to preserve even a piece of bone.
Well, in that period, it was the time of the persecution by the Romans against the small but growing Christian community all throughout the Roman Empire. And Lucia was actually from Syracuse.
From Syracuse, yes.
Syracuse, in southern Italy.
With a governor who took his responsibilities to the Roman authorities very serious. But I think it's pronounced Passatius. Forgive me, I don't think that's pronounced correctly. But in any event, a Roman governor of Syria. And this is what really led to her martyrdom.
Tell us about the circumstances of her martyrdom.
Well, it's very, very interesting. This lady was born of a very rich and noble family. And a lesson by there we learn, by the way, she was willing from her earliest years to want to put the resources of that family, to surrender them completely, as charity for the poor. Her mother, very fascinating woman, had developed an illness, was not quite as disposed to the completeness of her daughter's desire to consecrate her life religiously, but the mother develops an illness. She was persuaded by her daughter, Lucia, go to the tomb of St. Agatha, pray for a miracle. We will help you in that prayer process. Mother was cured. Mother takes on a whole new outlook. Now, she still wanted her daughter to marry, and the daughter was quite unwillingly betrothed to a young man. And the young man in question thought, oh, well, now, if she were known to be Christian because we're betrothed and she were to be executed, well, I'm her betrothed, I'm her inheritor of all the wealth that the church would normally get. So therefore, he denounces her to the governor, whose name I've just so poorly pronounced. The governor of Sicily then is required to begin a process of interrogation. The process determines, yes, indeed, I'm a Christian. No, I will not forsake the faith. And it left him wondering, now, what are we going to do here? Normally, the immediate punishment of a woman who has been accused of Christianity at the time was to force them to be prostitutes. Well, this didn't quite work. She said, absolutely, I will not renounce. You can do whatever you want with my body. Nothing is going to happen here. And she basically ridiculed him even for considering that. And he felt so annoyed, he then was going to have her executed by fire. Well, the fire and the logs and everything put around her wouldn't burn, no matter what they tried to do. So then he said, well, a sword will work. And that eventually is how her life was taken. And there's a wonderful lesson here that Christians today in Advent, I think, can really benefit from hearing. There were two attempts to kill the poor woman. They did not succeed. On the third one, she dies. And it reminds me of St. Paul writing about his own trials and tribulations, some of which he was certainly saved from, but others he was not. And for us who are inclined to think in our society that God will automatically rescue us, it's like if I put money in a machine expecting a candy bar. I put in my money, I get the candy bar. We think if I profess belief, if I go to Mass, well, then everything is going to turn out lovely. Her life, like that of Paul, proves that there comes a moment in which basically, fundamentally, we can't expect to do anything other than to confide ourselves to the Lord in such a way that He is free to do with us what He will, even if that includes at that moment not being spared death. We offer our totality, life and death, to Him in the Christian commitment.
Now, Saint Lucy, Santa Lucia, is also remembered for the symbol of light. Many people, especially in Northern Europe, celebrate Santa Lucia with candle lights, and it's a wonderful image at Christmas time, isn't it?
I think it's a very beautiful image. And I've seen, for example, in the case of the Scandinavian countries, where women will wear little crowns made of candles
exactly.
Mm-hmm. On St. Lucia Day. But the message beneath the light is not only that this woman who gave her life for the light of the world, Christ, and she gave her life for the light within herself of His Spirit that she so responded to seek to unite herself to God. But there's something about candles that very much represents her martyrdom, as all martyrs. A candle, when it is lit, ultimately will die by exhausting itself. It gave so completely, there'll be nothing left after a short period of time. So the candle becomes as important a symbol as the light. Mm. Because the candle is saying, I give my all till there's nothing left in the service of the one who is my light. The light has the right to claim my all.
And another woman who gave her all was, of course, Mary, Christ's mother. Tell us, why do we remember her so especially during this Advent period?
When we celebrate Advent, of course, what we're celebrating again is the return of Christ. A Christ who in His earthly life certainly gave His all, paralleling hers. Through our tradition, our Blessed Mother has continually been acknowledged as the new Eve, just as Christ is the new Adam. And so therefore it becomes extremely significant to see that a sinless Eve, who unfortunately didn't remain so, becomes then the promise of a Redeemer. Now a sinless new Eve brings forth the Redeemer. And so all through Christian history, we have this wonderful discussion culminating in what's called a dogma, a definitive statement of faith in 1854, that is saying this is the nature of the new Eve, to continually and always bring forth for humanity the new Adam, the Redeemer. And it is His redemption, which we're saying in Advent, is going to be culminated in His return. But it began in hers.
With the Immaculate
with
Conception.
With the Immaculate Conception.
Which the Church celebrates on December
8th. And do you notice, Tracy, it's very interesting. On December 9th, we celebrate the Feast of St. Juan Diego, who was the recipient of the revelation of Guadalupe. And
sure.
We celebrate Guadalupe immediately following the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And science today is telling us something remarkable about the cloth associated with Guadalupe. It shows, a pregnant woman, she's pregnant, continually giving birth to the Redeemer. And it shows also, so modern scientific analysis is saying, an extraordinary image in the eyes, in proper optical and scientific categories, the image of Juan Diego, who was being looked at by the woman of the tilma. And it's so beautiful to say Immaculate Conception is not a distant dogma. Immaculate Conception, the mission of Mary is what's being commemorated, reaches out even to such people as Juan Diego, commemorated the next day. And even as her mission continues for all of us, the pregnant woman on the cloth of Guadalupe, it all connects in a magnificent way, liturgically in our calendar, to express the mission of a mother, a mother who loves her children and is very close to all of us.
Of course, you were just touching on it, but it's December 25th, which we in the Catholic Church celebrate the birth of the Christ child and Mary, who brought him into this world. You mentioned the importance of a mother for all of us. At this time of Advent, what should we be reflecting on?
I think the fact that all of us, whether we're actually married, whether we're a parent, we have a parental sense within us. Because a parent says, I want to form and guide and shape and nourish and defend my children. But when you stop and think of it, isn't that the role of all Christians with relationship to every other human being with whom we encounter? And the birth of Christ, I think, is showing such a remarkable variety of responses. From, you know, the poor Christ child, literally poor, born in a stable, born amid animals, born with straw for his mattress, in a home that really wasn't his own, it belonged to cats, to cows and sheep and horses and what have you. There's a lesson there, that we too experience all kinds of poverties, maybe not from our birth. We talked about St. Lucy, born of noble parentage, but very really through our lives, we're afflicted and we're conflicted. Our Blessed Mother knew that. At the time of the Nativity, during her pregnancy, at the time of her Immaculate Conception, her parents would have had all the tribulations proper to their category of class and society and what have you. So she's very familiar with this range of human difficulties. And her son is born into the midst of that. That identifies him with us, but it also identifies her with us.
And she gives us this motherly courage.
Very, very much. There's a wonderful statement. I've always been very, very fond of it from the book of Genesis. And it's with reference to the old Eve. And the old Eve is told by God that as a result of the disobedience of she and Adam, that there would be enmity between he and the woman, referring to the serpent. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately she shall crush your head and you shall lie in wait for his heel. And this is what we call the proto-evangelium, the earliest sense of the real gospel, that a redeemer would come forth out of that disobedience. But what I really like about it, the word in Hebrew apparently, for he shall crush your head, or sometimes she shall crush your head. The serpent is being addressed. This is his punishment. And that we never know, does it mean he or does it mean she? If it means he, then we can anticipate Christ. And if it's she, obviously, it's the vocation of Mary. The enmity is definitely with her and the serpent. They're always at odds. Goodness is always challenged. But I'm delighted when I see the he, she, so confusing even to the language that biblical scholars don't know. Isn't it amazing to think that all through history, the role of the Blessed Mother is so entwined and just merged with the role of Christ that they're always inseparable in intent and desire and will, right from the language of Genesis to every apparition such as Lourdes that preceded the dogma. Everyone shows this wonderful association in every respect of the he Christ, of the she his mother.
Well, that's certainly something to reflect on this Christmas season, so thank you so much again.
You are
Father.
Most welcome. My joy to be here.
And a very warm thanks there to Father Bernard O'Connor, an official with the Congregation for Eastern Churches. Concludes today's program. Thanks so much for listening to us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Tracy McClure, wishing all of our listeners a very warm and happy Christmas. Laudator Jesus Christus.